Are you ready for some cartography-themed adventure? If the answer was no, perhaps you've taken a wrong turn, because this is Parallel Lives, your destination for unfamiliar role-playing of the analog variety. And today, the world is your atlas.
I am again your host, Bram, and I am joined today by Olivia S., hey. Raven, and Shannon, and we are discussing Avery McDonald's The Quiet Year.
Hi!
Hi.
The Quiet Year, like several games we've looked at in the past, is actually a world-building game, but it takes a different form than the ones we've talked about before in fairly dramatic ways. What it is world-building, but also a map-making game, and that shows up in a very physical way, because you start the game with a piece of paper out in between y'all, and as you explore your setting, you actually fill it in physically. And if you're a good artist, which I certainly am not, then it might even look good. And we'll have ours up online, hopefully, if I can get it to scan right.
I will say, right off the bat, though the world-building part of it was really fun, I am an artist, and the map-making part was kind of disappointingly secondary or even tertiary, so that is a thing to keep in mind.
You're given a really brief period of time to draw, because otherwise it would really derail the pacing of the game. So even if you're good at drawing, it very quickly moves into doodles.
The game does recommend, especially, like, you can even, instead of drawing a whole thing, just use symbols if that is better for you. And it certainly is better for me, because you'll see my art eventually if it all gets up there. I'm great.
Yeah, looking at our map, it does seem very symbolic rather than an actual cartographic document.
The other thing that makes this game system unique is the way that you actually go about adding things to the map and adding things to the game, and that is through the... Is it the Oracle system that
yes,
it's called?
The yeah, Oracle deck, I think.
Yeah, the Oracle deck. And this can take the form of either an actual physical deck that you can get from Bear Without Ceremony, which is where you can buy this game. Or if you don't get the whole deck itself, you don't buy that part, you can substitute by using a home deck of cards, normal 52-card deck, and then matching it up to the cards that are for free online. So, like, if you draw a two of clubs, you look on the key, and then you see what happens with the two of clubs, and then you go from there.
Also, the suits of the deck each correspond to one of the seasons, and each of the seasons are given a mood. So spring is about new beginnings, and then as you work your way through the year, finally, winter is about endings and, like, the hope of the community for things to move on, even though the players know that that's firmly the end of the game and also the end of the setting.
It's worth noting, too, with the other world-building games that we've looked at so far, by which I mean like Microscope and Kingdom, they allow you to choose basically any setting you want of any variety, and you explore that as you like. This one's a little bit more constrained, and what it is this is a post-apocalyptic setting. This takes place in a year, a quiet year, as you will, where our community is left more alone than normal. Something usually in past years we have to deal with something called the Raptors, I believe it was, from the...
We had to fight the Jackals.
The Jackals, that's what it was, yeah. And, like, I don't know if they're actual Jackals or if...
It was up to you to decide in the setting, if you ever did.
And this year we have been given the opportunity to expand and explore and work in our community some more than supposedly we could do in normal years. And we also know that the year ends when something called...
The Frost Shepherds
arrive.
Which is represented in a home deck by the King of Spades. And since the deck is randomized within the suits, the King of Spades can show up any time during winter, meaning potentially that your winter can be just one card long if you draw it first, which was another unique element to the game.
It's interesting. A lot of games have mechanics that make it so that when the end of the game happens is ambiguous, but it's a really long period for the quiet year, where it's effectively a whole season, which ends up being somewhere between half an hour and an hour, in real time, that at any point a turn can be the last turn and no one at the table knows that that was the case until the turn's already resolved.
Now, for actually setting up the map, you start with just the big empty space, and after you take a minute or two to discuss what the basics of it are, you each add one detail to the community. And in our case, we decided this was in the desert somewhere, some kind of desert, and we were all around an oasis, and so, like, one person drew the lake in the middle of the oasis, one person drew the ruins on the outskirts, old temple. I drew a sandstorm that was just outside the oasis that was kind of always going, and then one person drew the mysterious cave inside of the lake that just disappeared and reappeared seemingly at random, and we'd know what those were at first, but the idea is we'd be able to explore them and find out, of course. And then after that, the reason that it is called Quiet Year is actually a dual meaning, as you find out. Because not only is it a quiet year for your community in that you're not constantly fighting jackals, which is cool, probably, but also you are only allowed to talk and only allowed to discuss in very specific and very policed ways.
Which ends up making it feel like the game takes a year.
I'm really glad we started ignoring that rule and, like, making little jokes, because otherwise I knew I was going to, like, rage quit halfway through, because that was so not fun trying to be silent for the first part of the game.
Our game playing has changed simply from Microscope, the first game we've played, because it also had a similar you need to be quiet during your turn rule, and I feel that we were less jokey in between our turns, but there was more pressuring and influencing going on in Microscope, whereas in the Quiet Year, I felt that we were really good about, you know, just kidding around, but not actually influencing each other that much.
Did our best, at least.
We are only human.
We did end up, I think, group naming the archaeologist that arrived.
Oh, yeah, Mark,
because he's a archaeologist. If you're ever wondering, we're great.
Which is a running joke with the podcast by this point.
It's a running joke with me.
Get to the weekend.
Harsh.
Rough. Another thing that you determine on the outset that is pretty cool is that each person decides a resource that the community does use and does need, and then one of those is determined as an abundance, and, like, you have a whole bunch of them. In our case, the abundance was snakes. And the other suggestions are all deemed scarcities. In our case, the other resources were oil, which, as it turns out, we use for our various machines around, because we had some, like, tech still.
Water,
clean water, mm-hmm. Which was a scarcity we decided because we did not drink out of the lake. It was sacred. And
fish. I don't think we ever used anything about fish.
Yeah, fish never came up.
Yeah, but okay. I'm not sure what we ate. And I feel...
Snakes.
We ate the snakes. I totally...
No, yeah, the snakes were sacred.
No, we did. We
oh, yeah. I assume they were sacred because that was all our food.
Okay. Yeah, like, yeah, it's okay, like a yeah. deer... Buffalo. Yeah. To draw another comparison, this was similar to the palette from Microscope, and I felt that it was actually a little more interesting than the palette, because within the map building part of the game, we had to represent these scarcities and abundances on the map itself, which led to really cool little, you know, why is this a scarcity? Why is this an abundance? As Bram said, our oil was a scarcity because it lay behind the always raging sandstorm, or our water was a scarcity because we didn't drink out of the lake because it was a sacred lake, which I felt added a good amount of flavor.
It's funny that Olivia brought up the palette idea from Microscope, because I was also wanting to mention, I feel like the starting resources are intended to serve a similar purpose, where they begin to structure the foundation of your setting, but they don't function in the other important way that the palette serves in Microscope, to establish what the tone and elements of the setting are. And I felt like we had a lot of trouble establishing a coherent setting, because due to the combination of mechanics in this game, we're not supposed to talk, and we all have absolute authority in what we introduce, and we only briefly discuss how the setting works. We all had very different ideas on how we wanted the setting to go, and we were never given an opportunity to not even compromise, but find a way that these work cohesively as a whole. And I felt like, whereas in other world-building games, the longer you play, the better grasp you have of the setting and the better idea you have of what it's like to live there and what their problems are. The longer we played The Quiet Year, the later it got into the year, the less I had any idea what was going on. And it felt like we started a lot of plot threads that didn't make sense in the context of what I understood the setting was, and I had no non-ambiguous way to communicate that, which was frustrating.
The way that our game went was, as Raven put, a little piecemeal, I think, at least. Because we knew we were all in this oasis, and the game specifies, like, it's probably 60 to 80 people is your starting population, generally. And so we knew we were in this oasis, we knew we had a lot of snakes, we knew, you know, again, what our basic resources were and that kind of thing, but...
It was my impression, and we haven't done a lot of post-game discussion, that we each had rather specific ideas on what we wanted the setting to be like, where Bram seemed to introduce a lot of elements that had to do with machinery, and it seemed to have kind of a desert sci-fi vibe to it, and Olivia added a lot of, like, body horror elements, and Shannon added a lot of mythology elements. My interest is the only one that I actually know, which is I was interested in the setting having kind of an archaeology flavor, which is why I introduced an archaeology character and some, like, things that I intended to be historical mysteries. But because it's a world-building game, I would introduce something, and then it would be used for someone else's setting motivation. And so I would introduce something else, and that would also be used for someone else's. And as I thought, Bram's adjective was very good. The game ended up feeling very piecemeal.
I feel something that would have helped this would be a sort of prologue season, maybe the first winter, where you discussed the sort of the history of your community and how you came to settle there and what you were doing in the apocalypse. I think that might have helped to make it feel more cohesive, because as I was playing the game, the post-apocalyptic setting never really stuck for me. It was easy to forget that this was a, you know, in theory, post-man, post-society, that we were last bastion of survivors, to put it in a certain way. And I think more early world-building would have helped.
Connecting to what Olivia said about a prologue season, I think a prologue season would have done a lot to improve this game. I also think that if, along with the prologue season, the silence mechanics were seasonal, where we were allowed to talk a lot during the prologue season, and it was encouraged for us to establish what the tone and genre of the setting was, and then as the year progressed, we were able to talk less and less as our community became divided and was more and more preoccupied with basic survival and external threats. The book talks a lot about the game mechanics as a metaphor for how societies function, but I believe Shannon and I had a conversation prior to playing the game in which we kind of mocked how simplistic of a simulation of a community this game is. It's not like you're never given an opportunity to speak to the other members of your community except in, like, short little sentences. Was it you or was it Bram?
I think it was Bram. I walked down the road and I
went, fuck you! You see your neighbor coming out of their house.
I think this is a conversation you're having with yourself.
No way! I remember the joke someone else made. This wasn't my joke, and it was a good joke, where, like, you come outside and you see your neighbor, and you're like, hello, and your neighbor's like, hey, fuck you! And then that's the only conversation you have that week with your friend.
I find it interesting because the idea of being quiet was very deliberate, clearly. And, you know, I would certainly try out your hack for this game, the mumbly year. But I'm wondering how the creator of the game envisioned it going, because I don't think they envisioned it going how we played it, at least. Another mechanic that we haven't touched on yet is, in addition to being quiet all the time, or, you know, in theory, the way that you can communicate with your co-partners, with the people you're playing with, is that there's a pile of contempt tokens by the table, and you are allowed, when someone does something that you don't like, to take a contempt token, and you can use the contempt tokens either to do something just completely negative for the community, which is not normally what you want to do, or you can get rid of them when you see something happen that you really like, and then you can just discard a contempt token. And that's their only mechanical effect. The idea is, I think, that they're how you're supposed to communicate with people, but for us, they ended up being a little bit by the wayside.
To put that in a harsher term, the condemned tokens felt a bit like a joke, where somebody would do something, and then we'd all, like, oh, I'm so mad, I'm gonna take a contempt token. And I do like their, as Bran was saying, sort of meta use, where if you see people taking contempt tokens, you should think, oh, I shouldn't do that in the future, I will avoid this topic in my next turns. Their mechanical use didn't ever really come into play. I think if we did toss back a few contempt tokens when something we liked happened, but I don't think any of us ever discarded them for acting selfishly, because you do have this emotional connection with your community that you're building, so you don't ever want to say, I'm going to discard a contempt token and I'm going to burn down the village, and that's my selfish act. Like, you would never do that.
I did spend some contempt tokens during play. I think that in and of itself says how effective that mechanic was. It's difficult to communicate simply by putting back a contempt token, especially because there are multiple situations. You can either put back a contempt token when something you like happens, or when you're doing something selfish. So on my turn, if I put back a contempt token, the other players have to intuit that I'm doing that because I think what I'm doing is a selfish action. And furthermore, we're not playing specific characters in the community like we were in Kingdom. So the concept of a player being motivated by contempt to do something in the game world seems really strange, because as a person, I'm not actually in the setting at all. So I was annoyed as a player, so then as an ephemeral community member, I'm going to take a specific action. Like, it's a really weird idea, and overall, I think that because the contempt tokens were in place of talking, there was a tendency for it to be really ambiguous what you were taking a contempt token for or putting a contempt token back for, which I'm sure was an intentional mechanic, but in a game that players already have very limited agency, it felt frustrating that there was this vestigial system that didn't have any actual ground in the mechanics.
I don't know how much it felt like I couldn't tell why a contempt token was going back, because I know it wasn't so much being selfish as it was just something bad happened through the community and look what you've done, I guess. But at the same time, I agree that it was sort of weird, at the very least, a little bit by the wayside. And there is another method of communication that you can technically do. During your turn, it has a couple of phases. The first phase is you draw a card, and then the card will give you one of two options, and you decide what to do. And, like, the option could be a number of things. I'll put up a link to the Oracle in the show notes. But it'll be like, a charismatic young girl comes, and she's going to start a project, and then you start a project. Or it could be like, oh, a visitor has arrived of some kind.
Part of the thing that was cool about the Oracle cards is that there were usually good or bad outcomes for a certain thing. Like, there was a card that both of the options had a ancient artifact being found, but one of them was an ancient artifact is found, and that inspires wonder in the community. How does that change things? And the other one was a cursed artifact is found, and, you know, starts bad things happening, which was really cool.
Yeah. And then you continue your turn, and you get to either start a project, which symbolizes, you know, people making something new that you add to the map, or you discover something new, which is just something that you start right away, but it's not something created by the community. So, like, one of the continuing themes in our game, I think the thing that probably got explored the most, although it didn't end up going completely, was that there are various giant body parts found around in the desert. I, on a whim, had a giant eyeball appear in the sand, and no one was quite sure why. And then it became a theme that sometimes you'd be like, there's another eye, and a giant mouth, and a giant hand. But the other thing you can do on your turn is you can start a discussion. And for a discussion, you either ask a question or you make a declaration, and then each player gets to say 1 to 2 sentences, one at a time, and then that is your entire action for the turn. And that's it. Like, you don't get any other action. You get to start anything or anything like that. And we did a couple of discussions, but it felt a bit weird because the way we were doing them, and I believe the way it's doing the book, was in character. So it was like, yeah, the priests think the crows that have arrived are a bad omen, so we're going to ignore them. And so we're like, well, okay, you know, that's your entire turn. Like, maybe you can come back to it on your next turn, I guess, if you go all the way around the table. But it didn't tend to be what happened with us, at least.
When I obliquely said that there were things that didn't gel with my concept of the setting, I was thinking specifically of the giant body parts, which seemed to, as our game went on, increasingly be the thing that people did when they didn't know what to do on their turn. And they didn't really seem to amount to much and took up a lot of turns. And because the turns were very limited, it felt like it was wasted time both in game and in real life. And there was not really anything I could do about it or even voice that I didn't like them. And I kept taking contempt tokens, but no one seemed to understand I was taking contempt tokens, not because I didn't like that someone died and fell into the mouth, but because I didn't like that we were still talking about the mouth.
I don't know, I loved all the giant body parts. It had like a nice spooky flavor, and then I thought at the end that the Frost Shepherd ended up being this big old behemoth beneath the sand that has consumed the community, which I thought was neato torpedo, but it's, again, it's different taste for different folks.
Yeah, no, fair enough. I hadn't realized you were so down on the body parts.
That is why the contempt token system does not work. I thought that they were not fun at all, and had we discussed this setting previously, I would have at least been prepared for them, and maybe someone could have explained to me why they were a cool idea, and I would have had fun with them.
Giant body parts. Giant eyeball.
And, like, I thought the eyeball was creepy, and I thought that the mouth was creepy, and, like, the jabbering was cool, and these are all things that happen in the game, but as it went on, we had, like, a second eye and 2 hands and an ear and, like, all of these things.
A beating heart?
All of these things, especially because they were duplicates, like, you found a hand and then you found another hand, and, like, the
two
other
hands.
Hand doesn't really contribute anything to the setting, but it takes a whole extra turn. Like, I didn't like it at all.
One of the ideas, and it didn't come through, about the giant Heracles, was that it was going to be with the marauders that had entered our territory, and they were going to be whispering to it, and that was going to be how we were going to originally going to communicate with the thing.
That's pretty cool.
Didn't come through, like,
yeah,
I said.
See, and I had no way to know that you weren't just messing around, like, we weren't able to communicate at all. I'm not blaming the other people I played with, I'm saying I think that, like, I would have approached the setting very differently. I kept trying to add archaeology elements because I felt like we were in a desert setting. It seemed kind of Arabian Nights-ish. But everyone at the table was doing slightly different things.
So I was thinking, like, we'd be the last survivors on Earth, and that's what happened to the other people. They were subsumed into the ground to make this giant underground.
You all had,
like,
more interesting ideas than the no explanation that
there wasn't.
There
wasn't a vehicle in the game.
No,
that's
what I'm saying. I'm not criticizing your ideas. I'm criticizing the game for distancing us to the point that, which was the intention of the game, and to emulate the distance in a community. However, it was also a world-building game, and the lack of ability to communicate basic things of the tone and mechanics of the setting, I don't think that can be a positive thing to a world-building game. It seems very contrary to what's fun about a world-building game.
I felt almost as if we could have taken another year, almost. It felt like just as the game was mechanically winding down, with the final end of the game, it was at that point that we had enough mechanics and themes and characters to really, like, get going on the world building. Like, we could take another turn. I mean, the game we played took 3 hours, so it wouldn't really be feasible to play a huge 6-hour game of The Quiet Year, but I think the prologue season mechanic that I discussed earlier would have really helped with that.
I think it's a good idea.
The mechanic by which the last fourth of the game can end at any time felt a little strange, and maybe you'll have different opinions, but it felt weird just by, I don't know if we should be able to plan for the end of the game necessarily, and it's kind of cool to see something unexpected take a community, and like that's also the idea with the cards, because they throw a lot of very specific and different questions at you mostly, and that's interesting. But it also felt like Shannon had a cool idea where there was going to be a beating heart in this block of ice we'd introduced earlier. We were going to have all the body parts finally come to life and like things happen for like, you know, a climax. World building games don't need climaxes necessarily, but they're fun sometimes. It was fun in Kingdom. But that didn't actually quite get to happen, just because when we might have had up to like 10 weeks left, instead we were done.
I feel like maybe I was the only person who liked the discussion mechanic. I thought that while it didn't necessarily work in this set of mechanics and it didn't seem to interlock with the other mechanics in the game, I thought the idea of the players only being able to communicate in these brief, very non-back-and-forth discussions where I say one sentence and then we go around the table and everybody gets just one sentence and that's it. Had a really cool feel to it, just unfortunately didn't seem to connect well enough to the rest of the game, or at least to how we were playing the game.
Now, to talk specifically about what we did, because we've mentioned bits and bobs, the way the game works is a lot of new things are introduced earlier in the year, I think, and then later in the year, it's a lot of things changing in your community and various upheaval and stuff. And like our game started, we had our oasis, we had a couple of resources, we had some things to explore, and we did. We drew a couple cards and introduced some characters. We had a guy named Marlis. We had a girl named Annabelle who showed up and then never appeared again.
We had Jan.
We had a little kid named Jan who eventually got eaten, or who eventually disappeared, and then the mouth used his voice for the rest of the game, which is kind of cool.
And then he showed up in the palm of one of the hands, which I thought was nice.
That was nice. Good job, Raven. I think that was you.
Good job, Shannon.
That was not
good job, Shannon. That was definitely not Raven.
No, Raven hated the hand.
I thought that was the one thing you did with the hand. I was like, oh, good job. And we had a guy named Lancelot come in from a distant place and take over briefly.
But then he got eaten by the snake.
Then he got eaten by the snake.
I will say, as much as Raven complained about the giant hands, I feel like we all felt the same way about Lancelot.
No, I mean, I intended us to kill him quickly. That was fun. And he got eaten by the snake god, which we had established pretty well. And, like, it all seemed to gel with the setting. And I think that my limited ability to communicate with the other players kind of hamstrung this idea, but my intention was always for Lancelot to be... I imagine him as kind of a Don Quixote desert man who, like, stumbles into our community and bosses a bunch of people around briefly and is very actively crazy. And his first act as king is to make everybody drop everything and build him this, like, grandiose castle made literally out of sand. And it seemed like the other players did not have enough information to catch on to what I was trying to do with the character.
It's interesting that you say that, because while I was not particularly offended by Lancelot, although his name was not what I was expecting, I was a bit confused because...
It was intended to be a fake name. Like, okay. He went crazy in the desert.
Oh, I didn't realize
that.
Yeah. I was a bit confused because someone else started a project, which was a coup to oust Lancelot. And then I think you drew a card, which was, you know, a bad thing happens when your project gets finished. And the way you interpreted that was, well, Lancelot comes and he kills literally everyone involved in the coup.
That's a bad...
By himself.
That's a bad way for the project.
But I mean, that didn't discourage us from thinking of Lancelot as your pet character.
I mean, I didn't even necessarily think of him as your pet character. It just didn't really say Don Quixote to me, because Don Quixote could barely kill one guy.
No, it's true.
The man literally tilted at windmills.
I kind of lost... I mean, the game is partially randomly generated. Mm. You're also supposed to think quickly now, trying to keep the game moving. It might have been a little off-tone.
I mean to say, like, I'm not, like, angry or anything. I was like, that's the thing I remember being confused. Like, wow,
if I had a...
He's a badass.
If I had a pet character, it was the archaeologist that was stolen from me accidentally.
Mark Crow.
Mark, my Indiana Jones insert character, who was supposed to do something really cool that happened in my head that did not happen because the next time I got turned, he had already been turned into a weird bird man.
He was not weird. He was the avatar of the god of crows.
Yeah, don't hate.
No, I...
Mark had that with the snake god.
There you go.
Yeah, they were, but they had a peace treaty.
Not where I was going with him. No.
Archaeologist. And god of the crow.
Meanwhile, I played the game, just slowly expanding the little, train network that I built for some reason, which was slowly expanded to send off our pomegranates, which we grew a lot of pomegranates, send off our pomegranates into distant lands.
Is that a desert plant?
I don't know what they're grown on. I don't know how, what, where they grow.
You drew a muffin.
I did not draw a muffin, and I'm sure the internet will back me up on this. They'll look at that and be like, that's a fine grove of pomegranate trees.
That's a muffin.
Speaking of our abundance of pomegranates, the sort of unclear rules on the resources card were at times frustrating to me. There were very few card draws that would let you modify, like, usually adding scarcities and a few that added abundances, but it wasn't really clear how much your personal actions taken after that could influence that. For example, one of our scarcities was clean water, so one of my first projects was to dig a well, and that was a project that took a long time and underwent some problems, if I remember correctly, but then we had water, and was that enough water to cross it off our scarcities? How much water would be enough to add it to our abundances? So I felt a little unclear on that front.
I was also frustrated by those things, and I think additionally, it was a missed opportunity that there weren't more cards that were structured in the sort of way that would be like, if your community has any food scarcities, this happens. If they don't, this better thing happens. It felt like we spent a lot of time maintaining our list of abundances and scarcities, but they didn't seem to have any real effect and could, in fact, disappear quickly, which would be an interesting mechanic if they did something, but like, if I'm going to spend several turns of the game making it so that we have an abundance of pomegranates, and then the turn after that's done, I draw a card that says you lose a food scarcity, suddenly we don't have the pomegranates, and the pomegranates, A, weren't going to do anything for us in the game unless, like, we made it do something for us. And B, the pomegranates are gone now, so now they're double not going to do anything. Like, it... When I say that this game seemed to have a lot of problems with player agency, I mean that in addition to not seeming to have much influence over what the other players were doing, which is something that any world-building game has to navigate, it felt like there was a disconnect between our actions and the consequences that happened. Like, we could be building a really good society and then draw some bad cards and things would be bad for our society, but if we drew the same cards and we're having a really, really bad society, the cards would affect us the same.
Somewhat. I mean, like we already discussed, the cards often had a good or bad choice,
mm-hmm.
which I think was to encourage you to, like, balance it out one way or another, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes I just chose the one that I had a better idea for, because...
That's how I always chose,
yeah.
too.
I will concede that there were a few cards that were unequivocally negative, but I do
especially
think that...
Especially in Fall. There seemed to be a lot of...
Yeah, there were definitely a few, but definitely the majority of them were good thing happens, bad thing happens, and... As Bram said, it usually behooved the player to go with the option that you had a better idea for, and, you know, tragedy is easier to write than peace and prosperity. A cursed artifact turning everyone into wolves is a lot easier to write than a blessed artifact that makes everyone's life a little easier to pull something out of the air that never happened in our game.
I think our setting would have been improved with more shroom wolves. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah,
absolutely. If only. Oh, we had deer snakes.
Oh, we did.
We had a deer snake for some reason.
No, it was not... a breeding program.
Yeah, we
there
had several.
Were multiple
we had several.
Snakes.
Okay, well.
Enough to. A breeding population of deer snakes.
Because I misspoke. We ended up with some deer snakes.
That was the table talk that we weren't supposed to be having.
That was the influence.
It made it funner, so that's okay.
And it did make it more fun, and I feel like our running suggestion of ghosts...
Ghosts, which are our third thing. I told you, every time we have a world-building game, we have a stupid idea that comes up over and over because it's the dumb recommendation you give whenever someone pauses.
I think if ghosts had been in there from the beginning, they might have been fun.
Yeah, yeah. We have a scarcity or an abundance of ghosts.
I don't think that ghosts are a bad idea. I'm saying whenever this group, plays world-building games, we early in the game latch onto an idea that becomes our joke suggestion whenever someone fumbles.
We're great.
I appreciate that there's something called contempt tokens, because as a contemptuous person, I love to...
You would like to see more things.
In life, I would love to carry around a bag of contempt tokens and just
hold it up.
Stare at people
non-verbal
in the eye.
Fucking shelf.
Your neighbor comes out of their house. That was a joke that relied on a hand gesture, I'm sure that... The listeners follow.
But I'm sure this entire part will be cut.
Oh, I'm not sure.
Speaking of which, Graham, you should include a picture of our sweet contempt tokens that we use, the Skull and Crossbones.
Oh, I should have taken a picture. Maybe I'll take a picture before I leave.
Yeah,
right on.
They were pretty sweet, yeah. For the record, listeners.
Skull and Crossbones.
They were made by one of my parents' longtime friends, who is a professional pottery and arts person, and they have a very successful pottery business. Buying some of their pottery, their smallest pieces go in the realm of $90 to $100.
The weakest metal for scrub casuals, if you will.
I think they were made while he was
late
20s.
This is a super diversion.
Cut this, please.
Anyway, as
glorious leader, empress of parallel lives, I recommend you have sweet things in all your games.
Yes,
sweet things.
Sweet things in all of your life.
We're just gonna start using contempt tokens in all games.
I hope so.
Whenever,
like, legitimately,
you don't legitimately hope that. That means that whenever something I don't like happens, I'm gonna draw a contempt token.
Yeah,
we're gonna end all games with like a stack of
spiral
guns.
Everything.
What about the coin's hard edge, the coin-flipping D2 base system?
Yes, I'm excited.
I thought that this game was interesting in relation to Kingdom, because in a lot of ways they were similar but diametrically opposed, where they're both games about playing a small community that is constantly beset by problems that they have to find ways to work together to solve. However, they go about it in almost exactly the opposite way, where in The Quiet Year, it's actually impossible to play a character in a meaningful way or to communicate what a specific person in the community wants or cares about. Whereas in Kingdom, we played characters that, whether or not they were in the position that they represented other members of the community, all kind of worked together to define the character and thoughts and needs of the community we were playing in.
Speaking of the inability to control specific characters, the resources index card also included a column for names, as in named members of your community, which felt as though we were supposed to be using that, perhaps more than we did. I think, in the end, we only had a few named characters that we've discussed before. There were a lot of throwaway characters.
It was difficult to bring characters back, and you had absolutely no control over a character you introduced, so the mechanics kind of discourage you from coming up with characters, because if I introduce my archaeologist that I want to go and have this adventure, and someone else says, oh, there's an archaeologist on the board, he's going to do this. From my perspective, I might as well not introduce him, because it was mildly frustrating that he went and did something that I didn't want him to.
I suppose to summarize, it felt as though the game was trying to go in both directions with individual characters, you know, having the column for character names and having that as the mechanic, versus, as Raven was saying, the inability to really do anything with your characters.
I personally don't really mind like introducing a character and have other people play with them.
Neither do I.
But I did feel that it was a little bit hard to interact with them as much as I wanted to. My turn kept coming up, and I kind of wanted to do things with the characters. But though there were some questions that required you to introduce new ones or maybe ask you to do things with them, most of the time they just kind of sat there because most of the game is again about building the map. And I understand that that's the point. You know, that is what we should be concentrating on. But again, we had these little lists and I kind of wanted to expand the list and, you know, sort of see what the internal part of this community was beyond, like, well, there's some priests and there's some archaeologist and a crazy guy named Lancelot, but it just never happened.
Going back to what I was saying before, other people had things to say about what I was saying. When you read the manual to The Quiet Year, it's really clear that the author has a message they are trying to convey about societies and how they work. It feels to me as though Kingdom and The Quiet Year are built on completely opposite opinions of how a community functions, where The Quiet Year focuses on the sense of isolation within a community where you can be lost in a crowd, to cite a trite metaphor, whereas Kingdom really seem to focus on how the individuals are the community, that there isn't anything larger or smaller in a community than the people who live in it. And I think that at the core of why I didn't feel The Quiet Year's mechanics worked to communicate a community is that I don't agree that there is a larger entity that is more important than the individuals who reside in a given community.
I don't know if I would go so far as to say I know what the creator's opinion is on how communities are constructed necessarily from this, but I will say it's very clearly an experimental game. I think it perhaps just had too many ingredients in it at once. It's like, I'd be interested in a map-making game, and I am interested in a world-building game where you draw cards and stuff, and I'm not even necessarily disinterested in a game where you have to be very thoughtful about how you can and do communicate, but it felt like a lot of stuff put together at once that, for me at least, didn't gel. That said, I want to be clear. I think that this creator, Avery McDaldo, makes a lot of very interesting stuff. And this is the first game we've looked at on the podcast, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to be the last one. If you go to their website, and it will be linked to, there's a lot of varied and different products on there, and, like, for the record, if you want to buy any of them, A, some are free, and B, if you're really poor, you can actually pay for them by doing good deeds. Like, you can do enough good deeds, and then you send an email, and then you'll get a PDF, and that's pretty cool.
Oh, that made, when I read about that, that just made my respect for the author just shoot through the roof. I now love them so much.
Anyways, though, that is The Quiet Year, and here's our final thoughts. For my part, I would say, if you have the time, and if you have the desire, and if you're really interested in making maps, try it maybe. Just be aware of what we said, maybe consider doing your own homebrewing for it. It's not the top of the list, but I think it's at least interesting.
I enjoyed, I think, the idea of The Quiet Year a bit more than I liked playing it, and I would recommend it for artists and writers as actually a world-building exercise rather than a world-building game. I think that going through it by yourself, you could get a lot of really detailed focus on what your setting is like, would be useful for building something that you worked with in the future. Much like Microscope, it felt like the perfect way to, once you're finished with the game, now you have something else that you can keep working with. And I would, again, recommend it. I might, after this podcast is over, go through and just run it by myself.
Yeah, I really like the world-building aspect of it, too. Just everyone working together, and then, oh, the cool new things you thought of. Oh, awesome. And then, I guess, I like a chance to look at this map again and go over everything in my mind and maybe build it up in my head. And I really like the theme of it, like humanity keeps going, keeps striving, even if the Frost Shepherds are definitely coming, you don't know when, so you keep trying, keep doing projects, keep living, and I think that's really sweet. I like that theme.
I was really interested in us trying this system out, and I pushed really hard for it being one of the games that we tried on this podcast. Clearly, from my opinions of The Quiet Year that I have expressed, I was not extremely impressed with it. I think that I agree a lot with what Bram said, that there were a lot of really interesting mechanics that didn't really interact enough for it to feel like a cohesive game. And I think that most of the things that I liked about it worked better in Kingdom. However, I'd like to see a few different systems that use these mechanics separately, because I think that they were all really good ideas. I really like the idea of using a deck of cards to shuffle when events happen. I think that that's a really strong mechanic that could be used to make a really interesting game. And I'm disappointed that I don't feel that it was this game, but it was definitely a lot of new things. And if you're looking for something new, something that feels new, The Quiet Years is definitely one of the most innovative games I've played, even if the innovation doesn't necessarily go anywhere.
It's only $8 for just one good deed. It's a great, good deal.
Before the usual credits today, an opportunity. At the time of this episode's release, it will be halfway through October, which means that you, if you are so inclined, have a solid 15 days to enter into the Golden Cobra Freeform Game Design Contest. For details, head over to goldencobra.org, but it looks like a wonderful space for some exciting game experimentation. The Quiet Year, along with a whole pile of other creative designs, can be found at Avery Alder McDonald's site at buriedwithoutceremony.com. Our map, meanwhile, will be up shortly at parallelurl.com, which is also where you can find past episodes and extras from all the games we play. If you like the podcast and you want to hear more, or you just want to prove to us that we are not releasing audio into the uncaring void, please do rate and review us at iTunes or Stitcher, or if you want to contact the podcast directly, shoot us an email at parallelpodcast@gmail.com, or chirp us a tweet at parallelchat on the Twitter. Similarly, you can find Raven at absoluteapocalypse.tumblr.com, Olivia S. at starsystemic.tumblr.com, Shannon at abasketofkittens.tumblr.com, or myself at Wednesday Quest on Twitter. Our music was Ambient J, Thoughtful by Frank Nora. And once again, thank you so much for listening. Join us again next time, where I believe we will be talking about Avery Alder McDonald's Ribbon Drive.